occult phenomenon, mental health, legal and religious implications, Los Angeles, California.
Sponsored jointly by the Department of Continuing Education and Health Sciences of the UCLA Extension, by the Neuropsychiatric Institute, which is this facility, and by the Southern California Psychiatric Society. There are two very different public images of the contemporary organizations sometimes called cults, especially of those to which the adjective religious is usually attached. One of these images might be called utopian. It suggests the emergence of a healthy new spiritual sectarianism. This image portrays congregations of pilgrims who, after a search for meaning in life, or truth, or self-fulfillment, have found a band of kindred spirits under the benign guidance of a divinely inspired prophet, guru, master, or paterfamilias. They are busy living happily. Their bliss is only occasionally troubled by memories of the doomed society they have left behind, or the unwarranted intrusions of ignorant, misguided family members and their monstrous agents called deprogrammers. The opposite image might... This invokes the spirit of Dante Alighieri and his 14th century vision of hell. We see the cult as a place where men, women, and children are bound to a satanic master. They trusted him in a happier time, believing his promises, sinking by imperceptible stages deeper and deeper into his power, surrendering their possessions, their children, their very souls to his mysterious purpose. With Dante, we follow them to a distant place, where sighs, lamentations, and loud wailings resound through the starless air, so that at first it makes us weep. We hear, in the immortal words of Dante, words of pain, tones of anger, voices loud and hoarse. And with these, the sounds of hands making a tumult which is whirling through that air forever, as sand eddies in a whirlwind. Above the whispers of the damned, we might hear a single child's voice calling out, "I'd die for you, Dad," a quotation from the Jonestown tapes. My perspective on the cults is neither utopian nor infernal. It is, I hope, objective and scientific. All of the training and experience accumulated during 33 years in the practice of medicine, a completely detached observer would have to be from another planet. My own study of cults began in its serious stage, I'd say, as an outgrowth of earlier research on hallucinogenic drugs. This interest led me to study the people who were using them, first for presumably therapeutic reasons and then for recreation. This in turn led me to the hippies, the Haight-Ashbury, the counterculture, the rebellions of the 1960s. And following those subjects, since took me from the Haight-Ashbury to the communes of Mendocino County and to a great many organizations which took many individuals who were addicted or otherwise damaged by drugs of abuse in the 1960s and attempted to provide them with a healthier environment. Caretaking groups, including some that became cults by my definition, for example, Sinanai. It has been estimated that there are now 2,500 cults in America, the majority of which could be termed religious. I don't know how many there are. But however many there are, clearly they're not all the same. Elsewhere, I have differentiated them from communes, of which there are also many. The ones I call cults are characterized first by a strong or charismatic leader who directs a power structure of some kind. Second, by a manifesto, book, doctrine, or code, which, as interpreted by the leadership, governs the behavior of the members through various rules. And third, a relatively firm boundary that clearly defines who is in the organization, who is out, and who and under what circumstances may pass in either direction. The communes are quite different in all three of these respects. The term sect I use in the dictionary sense as a branch or outgrowth of an existing religion, although not necessarily so, but with emphasis on beliefs rather than on organization and power structure. To this relatively recent study of cults, I brought a long-standing interest in hypnosis, altered states of consciousness, coercive persuasion, often misnamed brainwashing, and certain organizations engaged in non-professional or idiosyncratic psychotherapies. Thus, I have observed and followed the growth and evolution of Dianetics since 1950. Dianetics, you will recall, became the Church of Scientology and thrived. In contrast, recently the Center for Feeling Therapy here in Los Angeles, which remained secular, collapsed. This corresponds with the history of utopian societies in California as studied during the century from 1850 to 1950. Some 50 of these organizations were studied, and in the actuarial sense, the lifespan of the religious ones was approximately double that of the secular ones, the average being 20 years. At the outset, let me specify certain things that I think must be kept in mind. Not all cults are religious. Not all religious sects, even new or strange ones, are cults. Not all cults do harm to their members or their members' families. And even those that do harm to some may benefit others. In fact, their practices may result in both benefit and harm to the same person. And talking to 50 members of such a group not long ago, I asked them how many felt that they had been harmed by their experiences, and at least 90% said they had. Then I asked them how many thought they had also been helped, and about the same percentage said they had. Certainly there are a number of cults or similar organizations that at some time pose significant threats to the well-being of some of their members. And because of this, our approach and the nature of today's conference has been to inspect these threats to well-being. This conference is not intended as a comprehensive forum on the nature of new religions, nor as a debate. It is oriented to look at one aspect of this problem. The harms or abuses that may come and how they can be corrected and how those who have been harmed may be cared for. I say this because we've received a good deal of mail protesting that our program is not balanced and that we should have had representatives of the cult organizations that is currently enrolled representatives, so to speak. The decision to do it this way was mine. If I were going to be sponsoring a course, let's say on sports injuries, with a view toward what to do about them and how to protect people against them, I might have orthopedic surgeons and those who are responsible for designing better equipment and so on. I wouldn't feel obliged to include people who wanted to talk about the benefits of physical conditioning or the joys of competition. Perhaps another model might be a public health model. We were having a conference on food poisonings. Even if only 1% of all canned string beans contain botulism, we would be concentrating on the various means of detecting it, of inspecting, and of treating the people who got the disease, and not about the benefits of nutrition from string beans. Therefore, we want to concentrate on the growing evidence of misdeeds or damaging practices by some of these contemporary organizations, whether they are perpetrated in the name of religion or psychology or healing or transportation to other planets or whatever. These threats are to a considerable degree covered up, minimized, and obscured by the organizations in which they transpire. Not unlike the activities of some manufacturers who don't want to change their practices, let's say, with regard to effluent into the waters or into the air. The implications of the rising power of cults go beyond the question of harm to individuals and their families. There are also important other civil issues. For example, in the election several days ago, the followers of Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh essentially took over the small town of Antelope, Oregon. As the Los Angeles Times pointed out on that day, the prospect of a so-called New Age religion becoming a city raises perplexing questions about the constitutional rights of religious communities and the meaning of self-government. For example, lead to the proliferation of new cult-like cities in remote places. Would such a city precipitate a church-state conflict because cities receive state money from taxes on liquor, tobacco, and gasoline, as well as qualify for subsidies and grants? Could the religious group's leader become an autocratic ruler whose bidding would be accomplished by a city council composed of his loyal subjects, and the city then be transformed back into the 16th century? And would the city's police chief have access to FBI files and crime labs and so on and so forth? But most of our concern about cults has been with regard to individuals who have been recruited, who have been members, and who have and who are still members or who have departed. Information has been accumulated from various scandals that have reached the media, from refugees, from families, relatives, friends, and from a few direct investigations. It's difficult to obtain hard data. Some cults systematically deceive the public, conceal information, harass critics, and intimidate or dominate their own members to prevent a free flow of information. Even so, existing data now suffice to convince any reasonable person that this is an important social issue, one that should be investigated, and one that has mental health implications. Today, a good many people are dead, dying, ill, malfunctioning, crippled, or developing improperly as a result of their involvement with cults in this country. Some of them are being exploited in that their lives and energies are being used for the benefit of a cult leader or his organization rather than themselves. Evidence is available to show that in the name of religion, persons connected with various cults recently have, and there are extensive documentation for all of this, harassed and intimidated members who try to leave the group, created ill feelings by members toward their families, murdered a government informant, harassed ex-members and investigators who attempted to investigate cult abuses, attempted extortion from relatives, amassed stores of weapons, misrepresented the true purpose of their group, received illegal employment insurance payments, plotted to infiltrate government agencies and did so infiltrate and stole government documents. Forced prostitution on members and encouraged sexual play between adults and children, sentenced a 9-year-old child to isolation in the desert for several months, beaten, hosed down, sexually assaulted, murdered, starved to death, and tortured members, even children, denied medical help for members under various conditions, including childbirth, induced illness and even death in members through improper dietary restrictions and stress, required members to obtain abortions, to engage in unhealthy behaviors, to marry strangers, and even to commit suicide. In spite of such evidence, however, we find a strange lack of public interest and attention to the phenomenon. Although, of course, the people and the cult organizations feel the other way about it. And one group that's very interesting to me are those that I would call apologists. These individuals, whose motivations are various or mixed, undoubtedly contribute to the veneer of respectability, but behind which strange and ugly things are happening. Some of the apologists appear to be romantics, projecting into the cults some of their own hopes for religious reform, spiritual rebirth, rejection of materialism, or even escape from the dangers of the thermonuclear age. Other apologists take a more seemingly pragmatic stand, shrugging off whatever abuses the cults may perpetrate, or denying that they're anything more than media exaggerations, while pointing out that any countermeasures would violate freedom of religion as guaranteed by the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Still, other apologists appear to have been successfully gulled by cult leaders or their representatives. Some declare that they have visited cults and been impressed by what they found. Others know someone who was in trouble before joining a cult and now seems to be much better off. Many of the apologists are armchair philosophers, really, who have never seen the destructive effects of these organizations. Others have some contact with carefully selected cult members but have never seen the raw operations or the devastating long-range consequences for some victims and their families. Still others are themselves direct or indirect beneficiaries of the cult's money, power, or influence, and thus hardly objective in their apologias, although they may pretend to be so and may conceal their connection with these organizations. They are, in a sense, lobbyists without full disclosure. The processes used by cults to recruit idealistic or lonely youngsters, to control them, to exploit them, have been described in detail elsewhere, and I'm not going to go into that myself today. The economic, political, and legal techniques currently employed by the cults to preserve and expand their wealth, power, size, and especially their respectability are apparent in many ways. These ways include the enormous pressures recently put on the University of California to cancel this conference or to change the program dramatically. Such pressures have included vicious personal attacks upon the participants, in which considerable deception and misinformation was used. Obviously, the cults and their agents don't extend their extremely broad definition of religious freedom to any great concern for freedom of inquiry or freedom of speech. The sustained and growing power of cults in America depends in no small part upon the influence of these apologists who are not apparently members or have no known connection with the cults. From the viewpoint of social science, it may be appropriate to look at these apologists more closely. Most of them are drawn from the following groups, although it should certainly be kept in mind that the vast majority of these groups are not involved at all. And when I say not involved, I mean one way or the other. First, mental health professionals and behavioral scientists. Many of these individuals have little direct knowledge about cult phenomena. Their inclination is to assume that those who enter cults have drifted into them, perhaps as an escape from a bad family situation, or in a search for relief from symptoms of psychopathology, or even to find an oasis of peace in the violent wastelands and social stresses of the modern era. Some colleagues sincerely believe that even the strangest of cults may be serving a therapeutic purpose, functioning as sheltered workshops for neurotic or schizoid youngsters. As Dr. Singer, from whom we'll hear later, has previously shown, certain published studies of cults are probably invalidated by the bias inherent in this orientation, a bias that affects the examination of the data. Such studies, by inspecting the victims or their families, tend to overlook the powerful techniques that cults apply to ensure a good supply of human grist for the mills of their power. There are even those who question whether such techniques exist, shrugging off the voluminous data, both clinical and experimental, on coercive persuasion, group dynamics, the power of the situational demand characteristic, and the impact of stress in successfully inducing compliance. Meanwhile, attempts by other colleagues to express views critical of cults and met with individual threats and harassment, as I mentioned, and even, I might say, of this building. Second, there's the media. Coverage can be described as spotty at best. There are a few exceptions. For example, the Point Reyes Light expose of Synanon, which won the Pulitzer Prize, segments of 60 Minutes, on Scientology and on the Worldwide Church of God, and a few others. However, except when faced with a major scandal or tragedy, newspapers have ventured very little into this arena. The reasons are clear. The media are largely commercial ventures. Their business is easily threatened by loss of advertising, boycotts, or lawsuits. Even more important, editors tend to keep hands off certain topics, like religion, unless there's something that's really news. Slaughter 913 people, that's news. Put a rattlesnake into somebody's mailbox, smaller news. The torture murder of a 17-year-old informant against a cult was given little coverage. And many stories by individuals that one might consider very interesting and newsworthy can't penetrate the media. By calling their systematic exploitation of people religious, certain organizations have protected themselves, in a sense, from the power of the press, because the religion page is not oriented to investigative journalism. Its purpose in most papers is in religion, and to satisfy the religionists and their version of the activities that will get coverage. Religion editors aren't supposed to offend anyone, and as a rule, they don't. As for television and radio, there's no religious news coverage to speak of unless someone shoots the Pope. Individuals who seek out the media to tell about their personal experiences, I say, get short shrift. In fact, a major TV effort to expose Jonestown 1 month before Congressman Ryan's visit to Guyana might have saved more than 900 lives had it not been squelched by NBC executives following harassment, letters, telephone calls, and threats of libel suits. Even books are not immune. One writer's expose of Scientology was withdrawn by the publishers, and the author's life nearly smashed as a result of Scientology's well-executed attack upon her, which they called Operation Freakout. Then there's the law and the political establishment. Now, the law is not a unitary or static thing. It's an enormous body of writ, documentation, history, and prose, billions of words on printed pages. But the law is also a living thing, a dynamic thing. Existing law is constantly being interpreted by judges to give it functional meaning. And new law is constantly being produced by those who are responsible for its creation, lawmakers or legislators. New laws also change old laws, and it is the duty of the courts, again, to make interpretations, to make those laws live, and have influence upon the affairs of men. If we look at legislatures and courts, it appears that they have made little progress in relation to the cults. Criminal justice people try to investigate cults, but are often frustrated by legal barriers. Given the growing body of evidence about the depredations of cults, and in the aftermath of Jonestown, where are the new laws? I'll mention one in a minute. It went the wrong way. Where are the fact-finding commissions, the hearings about whether such laws are needed and should be passed? Where are the public debates? This is as close to such a thing as we can provide, and it is not a debate. In 1974, a thorough investigation of the Children of God was conducted by the Honorable Louis J. Lefkowitz, that time Attorney General of New York. Abundant proof was discovered of coercive mind control techniques used by the group to intimidate and virtually enslave its members. However, the report concluded, despite the facts outlined, and I quote, "No direct action by the Attorney General can be taken at this time against the Children of God because of the constitutional protection of the First Amendment," next quote, end quote. Where are the judges whose view of the Constitution is such as to explore whether the First Amendment was really intended to provide immunity for con artists, brutal power mongers, or homicidal maniacs? As Tanay points out, the Justice Department's interpretation